This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Our thanks to Rocky and Le Chateau d'Adieu for that lead-in. The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on January 21st, 2022. As documented on the website of the American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU, 2021 set a record for the most anti-LGBTQAI+ bills passed during a legislative session. Over 100 of these laws were proposed in 35 states around the country, and these bills overwhelmingly targeted trans youth. While the attacks differ, some would ban medical care for trans youth, some would ban trans youth from school sports, and others would make it harder for trans people to get accurate state IDs, they are not isolated. They represent a coordinated campaign to push trans people out of public life. Among some of the highlighted gains for the LGBTQAI+ community in 2021, listed on the ACLU site, was a reminder that on day one of his administration, President Biden issued an executive order directing all federal agencies to recognize that existing federal bans on sex discrimination protect against LGBTQAI+ discrimination as well. A few days after that, Biden repealed the transgender military ban enacted by the Trump administration. And then later in June, the administration announced that the Department of State will now update the gender marker on passports without requiring medical documentation, and will add a quote-unquote X designation option. This new policy was the result of years of advocacy by transgender, non-binary, and intersex people, alongside a coalition of over 80 advocacy organizations and several congressional offices. As we've seen before, notes the ACLU, a more supportive federal government means those who are opposed to LGBTQAI+ equality moved their fights to the states. So, of course, how can we forget that here in Texas, legislators introduced a whopping 50 anti-LGBTQAI+ bills over the course of the multi-session 2021 legislative season? And if that political hostility in 2021 was any indication, the 2022 midterm election season promises to unleash a plethora of political ill will aimed at reversing any gains made by and continuing to subvert the human rights of these same individuals and communities. Good evening, and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at coop.org. I'm Michelle Manning Scott, guest hosting the program this evening, alongside regular host Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Alicia Roth Weigel, an intersex activist and change agent working to improve the political and social landscape for marginalized populations in the South and worldwide. Ms. Weigel is currently a human rights commissioner for the City of Austin, a member of the advisory boards for both Texas Health Action and Central Health, and founder of her own consulting firm, Intrepidus Strategy. Additionally, her activist writings have been published in the New York Times and Forbes. Welcome to the program, Ms. Weigel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Glad that you can make it. You know, you have a unique personal history story that has everything to do with how you identify today versus when you were younger. So why don't we start there and have you give us a bit of background on that?
Yeah, sure. I guess I'll actually start the story back a little bit further to give folks context and skip back to before I was born. When my mom was pregnant with me, she was in a car crash and the doctors performed an amniocentesis test to check on the pregnancy. And that amniocentesis basically told my parents that I had XY chromosomes. And based on what most people learn in school, you know, XY equates with male and XX equates with female. And so they were expecting a little baby boy, and they painted the nursery blue, and everyone got little boy gifts. And They were going to name me Charles after my father and both my grandfathers. And then lo and behold, in the delivery room, I was born not looking what most people think of as male, in that I was born with a vagina. And so immediately from the second that I was born, the doctors knew something was up. They would not have known had we not gotten in that car crash. They never would have known that I was actually born intersex until much later in my teen years, when I would not have gotten a period. I guess the context that that gives is that I was born intersex, and a lot of people don't have context for what that word means, or maybe they think it's like a fancy way of saying trans or whatever they might think. But basically, intersex is defined by the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights as people who are born with sex characteristics. And that could include anything from genitals to gonads to chromosome patterns that don't fit your typical binary notions of male or female bodies. So it's an umbrella term that's used to describe a lot of people who, quite literally, based on if you break down the word, are born intersex, between the sexes. And most folks have heard the word hermaphrodite, and it's kind of used as a slur or as the butt of jokes and things like that. And it also just paints a really false picture of our community, because people think that we're all walking around with two fully loaded sets of genitalia or something like that, when really that's not the truth of the matter, at least in human anatomy. Most intersex people, like, sometimes you can't even tell from the outside, like with me, for example, where on the outside, I look very quote unquote female. And the only reason they knew that something was different was because when my parents got in the car crash, they had done this test that told them about my chromosomes. And so after then doing more testing in the hospital, they realized that instead of having a uterus and ovaries, I had internal testes. And so that's kind of like my intersex variation. There are a lot of different ways to be intersex, and there are a lot of intersex people out there. We're actually almost 2% of the world's population, which is a lot bigger than most people think.
Yeah, that's a good statistic to bring up. People aren't aware of the fact that intersex exists as an identity, so to speak, let alone that there's 2% of the population that are of that identity.
To put that in context for people, it's about the same percentage of the population that has red hair. So I like to ask people that question. I'm like, have you ever met a redhead? And they're like, yes. And I'm like, well, then you've definitely met an intersex person. You just didn't know it. And sometimes that person might not know it, because oftentimes surgeries that happen to us in our infancy or in our childhood, or certain aspects of our medical records, oftentimes they've been hidden from us, or maybe our parents have given us not the full picture. I'm very lucky that that was not the case in my household. In a lot of countries around the world, there's still a lot of infanticide of intersex kids because there's so much stigma against our community. So oftentimes they'll just murder intersex babies when babies are born that way. I haven't heard too many instances of that in the States, but I do know that here a lot of times they'll try to cover it up. And they do that in a variety of ways. Like, either with me, the doctors would always tell me, you were born with this problem and you should never tell anyone because we're going to fix you and then no one will ever know. And just make sure you don't tell people because you'll be made fun of and you'll never be able to find a good husband one day, is kind of messaging that I got. But for a lot of kids, like, their parents are so ashamed of them, or there's so much stigma, or maybe the doctors or whatever, that they're lied to their whole lives and they might not find out till later. I was reading some story in The Guardian about a year ago that a 40-year-old woman didn't even know until she went to the hospital for a completely unrelated issue. So she didn't even find out she was intersex until she was in her 40s, which is when she found out there was some discrepancy there in terms of her hormones and her chromosomes, and that her body was not exactly what she thought it was.
Yeah, I've actually heard some stories along those lines too that I think clued me into that segment of the population that existed probably for the first time.
Yeah.
But you do have more history in regards to your own story.
I do. I was actually sterilized as an infant, because what often happens with intersex kids as well is they enact these forced, what we call quote unquote normalizing surgeries onto our bodies to try to make us fit better into an M or F category on a birth certificate. And so they enact these surgeries on us when we're too young to consent to the procedures to try to force us into a box that is not what we were naturally born into. And so they do that without a choice. And sometimes those are external surgeries where they will rearrange a kid's genitalia to make it look more quote unquote normal. And there are tons of stories where doctors have made that decision for kids. And you hear these horror stories where there's this like common phrase where they say it's easier to dig a hole than to build a pole. And what they mean by that is it's easier to make a vagina than it is to build a penis. And so they default to making little intersex quote unquote girls. And then sometimes these kids grow up and they're like, hey, I'm not a girl. I've never identified as a girl. Y'all built this onto my body without even asking me what I wanted or how I felt or how I identified. And so those kids end up then needing to transition later in life. And so they become both intersex and trans because a body was created for them by doctors without even them having any say in the matter. You know, the UN and the World Health Organization and Amnesty International, all these orgs, they define that as torture. They call it intersex genital mutilation. So, you know, when you hear the word genital mutilation and you think far off tribes in Africa or whatever, that's what I've heard a lot of people think. But no, this happens across the US every day in state sanctioned hospitals to intersex kids. But my surgery was actually internal in that they sterilized me. They took my testes. Actually, one of my intersex superpowers would have been that my body, my intersex variation, which is called complete androgen insensitivity, it means that my body is insensitive to androgens, which are quote unquote male hormones. So it means that once my body reaches a certain threshold of testosterone, it starts automatically converting it to estrogen, which is kind of a cool superpower, if you ask me. So my testes that I was born with, they would have produced testosterone and my body would have converted that to estrogen and I would have just developed naturally on my own. But because when they identify that you're intersex as a kid and because society likes neat little boxes to kind of shove people into in whatever regard it might be, they do these surgeries to quote unquote normalize you. And for me, they told my parents that there was a risk of testicular cancer. And when you're a parent and you hear that your kid might get cancer, you want to do whatever you can to minimize that possibility. So they told my parents I could get testicular cancer. And so they were going to remove my testes while I was like an infant. And so that's what they did. What they didn't tell my parents is that my rate of getting testicular cancer was actually lower than the risk of testicular cancer for cis males who have external visible testes. So a very low risk of cancer. And they didn't explain to my parents that by taking my testes, they essentially were putting my body into hormone withdrawal as a child, because those were my hormone producing organs. And then I was going to grow up in hormone withdrawal until they started giving me external hormone replacement therapy. So I basically grew up like in menopause as like a toddler and a kid, because I was lacking certain hormones that I needed until they started giving me hormones in my teenage years. All this is to say that's how I grew up. And if you're not getting the picture, it's a lot of hush hush. It's a lot of traumatic medical experiences. And so of course I'm not gallivanting around telling everyone this all the time. And it's something that I shoved really, really deep in the depths of my subconscious. I didn't even acknowledge with myself. Not even my brother knew. Only my parents knew. And I came up with these really good lies my whole life. You know, I would carry around tampons, even though I could never get a period, so that my friends wouldn't ask questions about why I didn't have tampons. You know, you create this whole facade of like a person so that no one will discover who you really are. How I actually ended up finally owning my identity, because as I mentioned before, so much of my life I spent thoroughly closeted. I wanted nothing to do with this identity growing up because it was never framed to me like, you're part of this population of people around the world. If you extrapolate 2% of the world's population, that would be like 150 million people around the world, basically half the population of the United States. There's people like you everywhere, and it's just a natural way that people are born. And diversity is beautiful and there's all different ways to be a human and we're here to support you and love you and help you find your path in the world. It was never framed to me like that. I was always framed like, you can't tell anyone because you'll be made fun of and you won't find love. And the way that you hear that as a kid is that you're unlovable for being who you are and just for simply the act of being born and how you were born. And I know a lot of the broader queer community can identify with that and having spent their childhood feeling like they were inherently a problem simply for existing and with certain aspects of their life that are beyond their control. I lived that way for 27 years until I ended up moving to Texas in 2016 to help Wendy Davis, who was a former state senator, she ran for governor, to help her launch a nonprofit called Deeds Not Words. And that nonprofit, which is still in existence, works to train young folks about how to use their voice in support of gender equity. And so at the time, she and I were training all these high school and college age students about how to share their stories, primarily about sexual assault and human trafficking, because another sad reality is that most young women in the United States have either been assaulted themselves or know someone who has. The statistic is something like 1 in 4 women will be assaulted throughout their lifetime, which is wild. So we were urging these young people to share their stories about what happened to them, both to heal themselves and free themselves of trauma and for cathartic reasons, but also to help other people and to use those stories to help pass legislation that would protect other people from going through what they had gone through. And I'm also a sexual assault survivor, so I related to a lot of these young people. And yet I also felt like a big hypocrite because here I was urging people to come forward and be authentic and own their truth to help themselves and help others. And there was this huge part of my truth that I had deeply buried and closeted and that I never shared with anyone, even within my own immediate family. So basically, fast forward to 2017, the Texas legislature was trying to pass the bathroom bill, which, if listeners are not familiar, was bills that would have shut down the ability for people to use the bathroom of their choice, and they would have to use a bathroom that aligns with the sex on their birth certificate, which, besides being unenforceable, who carries around a birth certificate with them, would also just negate the experience of so many trans people and non-binary people, et cetera. So they were trying to pass this bill, and I basically went and decided that it was my time to come out because I realized that my story shed a lot of light on that particular issue and that I was born with both testes and a vagina, and it says female on my birth certificate, but I have XY chromosomes, and that the way that they were thinking about bathrooms just didn't align with the reality of biology. And so I was basically there to ask them where I was supposed to pee. So I ended up coming out as intersex for the first time in front of the Texas Senate when I was 27 years old. And that was really my first time ever publicly and or even privately owning my identity as an intersex person.
This is all really touching. A lot of memories in my life. I'm an openly gay man, you know, coming out. I guess I'm still coming out in many ways. I congratulate you. There's the whole issue of coming out, and then there's the whole issue of identifying and finding a community, as it were.
Totally.
Can you speak to that a little more about how do you find other intersex people?
Yeah, it's such a good question. Congrats to all of us for being out here in the state of Texas, where it's not often the safest or easiest place to do that. But
Right. Finding
community as an intersex person can be really hard because so many of us, like myself, don't either find out till later in life or don't have the courage and ability to come out till later in life. And so it is hard. And I do think that just like with being gay or with being trans, like the more visible it becomes in society, the easier it'll be for people to come out earlier. And then hopefully one day get to a point where no one's forced to come out because it's just something that we all admit about people from when they're born. But in the meantime, in today's current day and age, when I did come out, it was on the news and GLAAD, the organization, did a piece about it. And so immediately it flew onto the intersex activism community's radar, and other intersex folks started reaching out to me online through Instagram and Twitter and other social media. And that's kind of how it tends to happen, because we're a lot larger than we were when I came out in 2017. We're certainly a lot larger than we were a few decades ago when intersex activism really started heavily in earnest throughout the US. The community is all still very close-knit. There are pluses and minuses to having a small activist community. The negative is obviously that there are so few of us that are out, that we all have a lot on our shoulders and we all feel this need to be everywhere until more people come out and more people can share the burden of our activism. But then the plus side is that because we are a small community of out intersex activists, it means that I actually know the vast majority of out intersex activists around the world. And most of us talk pretty consistently. We actually have a group we call Club Intersex that is run through the Los Angeles' LGBT Center, where I believe it's once a month, it might be once every 2 weeks, but any intersex person is able to dial in, and it's just a safe space for us to connect. And sometimes we do like journaling exercises. Sometimes we just kind of hang around and shoot the breeze. So we do try to build communities, even virtually, through stuff like Club Intersex. And then we also have two amazing organizations in the US. One of them is called Interact, which stands for Intersex Activism. They have support groups for parents of intersex kids. They have an intersex youth group that goes up to age 30 that I was very active in until I aged out, as well as Intersex Justice Project, which is an organization specifically focused on the experience of intersex people of color. So people who not only face marginalization for being intersex, but also are Black, Native, Latine, or whatever intersectional identity of race and ethnicity that layers on top of being intersex. So there are really great resources out there. It's just hard for intersex people to find them if they don't know. So hopefully anyone who's listening to this that might be looking for a community, I would definitely look up Interact or Intersex Justice Project.
Your activism around your intersex identity obviously dovetails with a lot of what you do for your work life as well. You're deeply embedded in all this advocacy and policymaking through both your daily life paid work and also with your volunteerism, I understand, here in the community.
Yep.
So I wanted to go into your work as a human rights commissioner here with the city of Austin. Can you talk about that? Maybe start with the basic description of what the Human Rights Commission is, its function within the structure of the city services, and then how maybe you came to be a member of the commission.
Yeah, totally. And this is a good opportunity to help people learn about boards and commissions more generally in the city, because it's such a great way to give back to your community. The city of Austin has a variety of boards and commissions on so many different issues, everything from zoning and transportation issues to public safety to issues that affect specific identity groups. There's a commission for women, there's a commission for LGBTQIA+ individuals. And the primary purpose of these commissions is to meet once a month as a deliberative body and talk about ways to improve the work that the city is doing from the vantage point of that specific commission's purview. So the Human Rights Commission is a little different in that we're not just looking at, you know, the Asian Austin communities or Black Austin communities or one particular identity group, but we're looking at the broader cross intersection of human rights issues for all Austinites. And our role as commissioners has been twofold. So first off, we help write and enforce Austin's non-discrimination ordinances. Basically, that means our local laws that determine what discrimination looks like and help enforce that people cannot be discriminated against. So whether someone is fired for being gay, or if they're kicked out of their housing for being HIV positive, whatever it might be, none of those things are legal. but people need to have recourse if that happens to them to be able to have justice served. And so we, as a commission, are tasked with not only enforcing those non-discrimination ordinances, but we basically advise the city about how to improve their current policies and make new policies that strengthen the protections for human rights for all Austinites. So I was appointed by Councilmember Greg Kassar back in 2018. I believe I started service in 2019. And that's how these commissions work, by the way, is each of the 10 city council members gets to appoint a commissioner to each of these boards and commissions. And the mayor then gets to appoint a few commissioners, I believe, more than one to each commission. So Councilmember Greg Kassar appointed me to this commission based on my work in intersex activism, understanding that there were no openly intersex commissioners at the city of Austin and that this is an important perspective that needed to be heard. But I definitely do a lot of intersex work within the commission, but we as a commission do so much work beyond that. And I myself, in terms of what I've led within the commission, has spanned really far beyond that. Everything from working on the updates of our land development code as a city, so determining new housing and making sure that housing is accessible to all Austinites, new and old, from all income levels. I also do a lot of work on homelessness, so was part of the original task force that helped decriminalize homelessness in the city of Austin. Unfortunately, a lot of those policies were repealed after, but that was something I was really proud of, was my work with the Homes Not Handcuffs Coalition. I've also done a lot of police reform work with the commission, everything from our 2019 police budget, where we called to divert funding towards mental health emergency responders, because so much of 911 calls could actually be better alleviated by people who have mental health training or are social workers and come from that background versus people who are not equipped to deal with those situations. We've done a lot of police oversight work and making sure that complaints are investigated by APD when there are issues of abuse of power. I've really worked on all different issues that pertain to the human rights of Austinites, and hopefully will continue to if I'm reappointed by the next council member who comes out of this special election.
We're speaking with Alicia Roth-Weigel, a change agent working to improve the political and social landscape for marginalized populations in the South and worldwide, which includes intersex people like herself. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at koop.org. I'm your guest host, Michelle Manning-Scott, alongside regular host Bob Daly. This evening's program was home-crafted and recorded on January 21st, 2022. We're speaking with Alicia Roth-Weigel, a change agent working to improve the political and social landscape for marginalized populations in the South and worldwide, which includes intersex people like herself. Let's continue.
Well, I didn't realize you're on an advisory board for Texas Health Action. Is that right?
I am, yeah. So Texas Health Action, for people that don't know, is the parent company of Kind Clinic.
Right.
And Kind Clinic is a series of clinics throughout Austin and San Antonio and soon to be Dallas. But basically, they are sexual health and wellness clinics that specifically cater to the LGBTQIA plus community. So they offer access to PrEP and PEP, HIV prevention medication. They do STI testing and HIV testing. And actually, what I've primarily been working on with them in my time on their community advisory board is helping their work become more intersex comprehensive. I was actually there as a patient getting help with my gender care. I mentioned earlier that because I was sterilized as an infant, I've had to be on what we refer to in both trans and intersex communities as hormone replacement therapy, or HRT. So Kind Clinic was helping me with my HRT, but I found that they were lacking in a lot of their knowledge on how to best help intersex patients. because we have a lot of overlap with the trans community, but there's also a lot of difference. A lot of us have extreme medical trauma. A lot of us are not actively trying to transition in one direction or another, but we need to keep track of our hormone levels to help promote good bone density so we don't get fractures. And a lot of intersex people get early stage osteoporosis actually because doctors pumped us with hormones when we were so young that actually sometimes leaches calcium from our bones. All this is to say that Kind Clinic does incredible work. I saw some holes that I thought they could fill for intersex patients like me. And so that urged me to join the community advisory board. And since then, we've done all staff trainings to make sure that everyone from the receptionist to the doctors to the patient advocates are all aware of my community and the best ways to serve my community. And just to make sure that all of Kind's services are really thriving. And just a quick plug as well, that even people that can't attend Kind's in-person clinics, they actually offer virtual health services across the state of Texas through Telekind, T-E-L-E-K-I-N-D. So if anyone's listening who's cruising through Austin or doesn't live in Austin, lives in a more rural area and can't make it into town, you can still access Kind Clinic's care through telemedicine. I'm really proud of that service too.
And very grateful for your work there. It's a wonderful organization.
Thank you. It's just such a great resource. People with and without insurance can access their services. So anyone who's listening should definitely not be afraid to go check them out.
You also mentioned that you are doing some work with the White House. I'd be interested to find out, I think it's policy work maybe that you've been involved with?
Yeah. So intersex policy work, we have people working at every level of government trying to make things better. I can speak a little bit to the broader policy landscape, and I'll do that. I can obviously speak best to what I've been involved in. So here at Austin City Council level, back in 2019, the city of Austin first ever recognized Intersex Awareness Day, which is October 26th. We hosted a big rally in front of City Hall where the mayor spoke, Councilmember Kassar spoke, a bunch of trans and intersex advocates, doctors, parents of intersex people. So that was really exciting to bring that visibility to the Austin community for the first time. And then 2 years later, this past fall in 2021, we were able to pass a city ordinance, local level policy that formally condemns these non-consensual surgeries that happen on intersex people like me. We are the second city in the US to formally condemn these surgeries and then offer to provide education to parents and doctors of intersex kids so that they can make better informed decisions than what my parents and doctors were able to 31 years ago. New York City was the first in the US to pass, and then we were the first in the South to pass legislation like that. So those both felt like big wins here at the local level. At the state level, things, as I'm sure y'all can imagine, are a little bit harder. The environment up at the Capitol is not quite as amenable to us passing positive legislation. And so my work at the Capitol tends to be a lot more killing bad bills, like what I did with the bathroom bill, versus actually pushing for good bills. Most recently, a lot of that work was trying to kill these anti-trans sports bills, which a lot of people don't understand affect intersex kids too. For example, they're going back to the sex on your birth certificate, and it says female on my birth certificate. So that would be the team I'd have to play on, even though, I mean, I have XY chromosomes. I was born with testes. Like, it's not as simple as what folks would like us to think. But also, I mean, it would involve forced genital exams on kids like me to be able to determine that I'm on the right team, which is extremely invasive and just so unnecessary. I mean, a lot of my conversations at the Capitol have been like, can we please fix the power grid? And can we stop worrying for a second about what's in little kids' pants and what's between their legs and like focus on our state's infrastructure for a second? Anyway, so the state level has been harder to move things forward. Other states, however, have been able to do really good work. California in 2018 condemned these non-consensual, medically unnecessary surgeries on intersex kids as a state. They were the first state to do so. And then in 2019, they started working to not just formally condemn them, but to prohibit these surgeries, which a lot of other countries around the world have already done, from Malta to Germany to Portugal. The US is actually not at the forefront of this stuff. We're actually woefully behind a lot of the rest of the world on intersex protections. We are also woefully behind on so many issues of human rights in this country. But to stick on this topic, at the state level, there's a lot of good work specifically being done in California and New York. In New York City this year, after that citywide ordinance passed to condemn the surgeries and offer education to parents and doctors, they now are working to do something similar at the state level. There's a bill that's in the New York State Assembly that would basically fund education for parents and doctors of intersex kids across the state of New York, which would be amazing and something that hopefully maybe one day we could replicate here in Texas. And then lastly, at the federal level, the intersex community work caught the attention of President Biden's administration. And I've been part of 3 meetings so far. 2 were much smaller meetings. One was a larger listening session where they invited intersex activists of all ages and all different identities from across the United States to share our experiences and share about our work and to help inform some of the federal policy moving forward, everything from medical policy, obviously, but education policy, identity-related policy. And it was actually the day after that listening session that the Biden administration added the X gender marker to birth certificates and passports. I do want to clarify that that is not always our desire as an intersex community. It happened as a result of our work with the intersex community. What we fight for is the idea that actually this concept of gender and sex as we have it, it's not that there's male, female, and then X. It's that there's actually just a broad spectrum. Just like there's a spectrum of sexuality or just like there's a spectrum of gender, there's also a really broad spectrum of sex because so many people are born somewhere in between like me. But, you know, it is a start and it shows that they're listening. And we plan on continuing to work with whatever administration happens to be in office as long as they're willing to work with us.
We're running out of time here, but I did want to ask a question that I have. From your perspective, being in all these political circles and everything, what do you foresee as some of the bigger challenges to human rights overall that we'll be facing in the upcoming elections? And do you have any thoughts on how best to counteract those threats?
Yeah. Wow. That's such a loaded question.
Sorry.
It's such a loaded question. It's such an important question. I think the current presidential administration has not done a great job on some things. They've also just been in unprecedented circumstances, right, of a global pandemic and unprecedented polarization in the United States, et cetera. And so I'm not saying it's all their fault, but I do think that the American public tends to look at things as their fault. And what often happens for everyday people who don't have their time to be plugged in all the time and understand the political process, because, I mean, people have bills to pay, a lot of times they will project whatever they see as the faults of a president across that entire party. I have a lot of critiques of the Democratic Party. I also think we in Texas can see that for any valid, very valid critiques we may have of a given party, there are very different levels in terms of how each of the two parties treats human rights specifically. We have seen the Republican Party in Texas strip reproductive rights and reproductive autonomy, which I do want to make clear that I was sterilized as a kid. That is very much an issue of reproductive justice, and abortion justice and intersex justice are inextricably tied. We all should have the right to decide when and whether to have children and what to do with our own reproductive organs. So, you know, we've seen them strip our reproductive rights as women, as intersex people, as people of any gender, deciding when and whether to have kids. We see them right now very successfully stripping our very right to vote. And you see federally, all of these legislators of color and specifically Black legislators hearkening back to Jim Crow and saying these laws that we're seeing to restrict voting in the US, we haven't seen since the Jim Crow era. I think living in that reality here in Texas, it's scary because people are so, and again, I'm not here to shame people for critiquing their presidency because we have every right to, and that's what we should be doing as Americans, is critiquing our government and holding them accountable. I just do worry a little bit that the backlash is going to be that we're going to lose the House and the Senate, and it's going to be really, really hard. So much of human rights is determined in the court systems, actually. And when you look at the highest court of the land, the Supreme Court, the ability for the Republican Party to have stacked that court with people that are anti-choice, that are anti-LGBTQI plus rights, that are anti-criminal justice accountability, it really scares me what we're already sliding downhill on so many of these issues. I've been talking in this like policy level, but when you look at just the human experience, you see people like my mom being like, I never expected to live in a country where my children would have fewer basic rights than I did. And that's what we're seeing in the US right now. And it's really, really scary. So I would urge everyone to get as involved as they're humanly possible to be able to be involved, given their family and their jobs, et cetera. It's a scary time for human rights in this country, for sure.
Yeah, I have to agree. Hence my question, just wanting to find some hope someplace from somebody who might have a read on it better than I do.
Yeah, and you know where the hope will come from is, I think when you look back at the 60s and 70s and this like great upheaval of social unrest and political unrest and things really changing in this country, a lot of that generation is older and more tired and has passed the torch, but at least that generation voting. And we need my generation, we need millennials, and we need Gen Z voting. And I think if people understand that TikTok and Instagram are incredible for visibility and getting the word out, but you can't vote through TikTok and you can't vote through Instagram, and we still need to do that basic work of showing up at the polls. And just that, like, each and every one of us can have such an impact. That's what gives me hope. My friend Tim, he was part of this voter suppression here in Texas. He registered properly, but he registered using his social security number and then had his driver's license as his ID that he used. And so those didn't match until they refused to let him vote. And I was able to then re-register him for next time and help plug him in with the elections officials to make sure he could get a provisional ballot for this particular city council special election. And I just think that, like, it's easy and makes sense to feel overwhelmed by everything happening at the systemic level in this country, but there's so, so much that each and every one of us can do, whether it be registering voters, whether it be sharing radio stories like this one to help people understand what's at stake. I think if each of us understands that democracy doesn't function when left alone, it only functions when we participate. That's what the word democracy means. It's an inherently participative form of government where it only works when all the people are involved. That's what gives me hope. I actually don't believe every one of us has to go out and run for office. I know we had that phase a year ago when it was like, everyone should run. And like, I agree, everyone can run and everyone should be able to run, but not everyone needs to run for office. There's so much each of us can do in our day-to-day lives. And that's actually the pieces that give me the most hope, is when I see my friends registering voters, or when I see them sharing radio shows like this, or having those tough conversations at their Thanksgiving dinner tables with their, you know, racist uncle or whoever it might be.
Amen. Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts, sharing your time with us. Before we go, though, I do want to give you a chance to give us some contact information for people who might like to reach out to the Human Rights Commission here in Austin, and also possibly you, and maybe if you wanted to go ahead and give the contact information for the organizations you mentioned at the beginning of the show, the intersex communities.
Yes, absolutely. So first off, I think if you want to continue to learn about intersex issues, the easiest way that I tell folks is just to follow a bunch of intersex activists on social media, because that way you're getting bite-sized pieces of information about our lives on a regular basis, not just like a big dump all at once like today, where you might not remember a lot of what was talked about. So if you do want to follow me, I have the same handle on Twitter and Instagram, which is XOXY. My chromosomes are XY. So XOXY underscore Alicia, which is A-L-I-C-I-A. And then as far as the Human Rights Commission goes, the best thing about the Open Meetings Act of Texas is that y'all are welcome to attend all of our meetings. Some of them are virtual at the moment. They're usually the last Monday of every month. So if you just Google Human Rights Commission Austin, you can dial into our meetings. You can click on a list of all of the members to access our email addresses and phone numbers, including myself. And I definitely would urge anyone to reach out if you have any questions about today or anything related to human rights issues. I'd be more than happy to speak with you.
Well, thank you again.
We really appreciate all of your efforts. Keep up the great work and all the best to you, Alicia.
Thank you so much. Appreciate y'all and can't wait to keep listening to the show.
It's Friday afternoon, January 28th, and time for Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How are you on this blustery Friday afternoon, Austin?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me.
So I hear that City Council met yesterday. I'm just curious, who represented District 4?
Right. Yeah. First meeting of the year, second to last meeting for Greg Kassar, representing District 4. The council meeting on February 3rd will be his final meeting, so the one later this week. Yeah, the next meeting, which probably won't be for another 2 weeks, is going to be Jose Chito Vela, the outright winner of the special election held 1 week ago on Tuesday.
And it didn't go to a runoff.
No, this was, I guess, somewhat of a surprise. Vela was always considered the front runner. Stacked up endorsements, raised a bunch of money for a race like this. But yeah, he ended the night with nearly 60% of the vote, which, you know, as we've talked about before, so long as you get above 50% in a race with more than two candidates, you'll win outright, you know, without the need for a second runoff election. As people watching this election predicted, it was a pretty low turnout race. Just over 3,600 people voted, which is just a little more than 10% of the registered voters in District 4. And Vela, you know, walked away with more than 60% of that vote. And none of the other six candidates really even came close to that figure. Monica Guzman finished second with just about 14% of the vote. It was kind of obviously lower percentages from there. So a really strong showing from Vela, again, amid some pretty heavy spending in this race for what was a special election, a weird timed first of its kind election. Since the 10-1 council system was adopted, we've never had to replace a council member in the middle of their term. So it was the first one of these special elections that were held. And there was kind of an outsized amount of spending from political action committees in the race that didn't really turn up much vote. Jade Lavera was a candidate supported by a PAC called Voices for District 4. We don't know the final amount of money that they spent yet. We'll know when the candidates and their PACs supporting them post their final campaign finance reports. But as of the most recent ones posted right before the election, this PAC had spent, you know, close to $40,000 on Lavera. And for all that money, their candidate brought in 402 votes, right? So not a very good return on that investment, but kind of an interesting look, I think, at what we can expect to see in the council elections that are going to happen later this year in November. I expect we'll see more of this PAC spending and maybe more than we ever have in citywide elections.
Well, that's about $100 a vote, wasn't it?
$100 a vote's a little more than you want to spend if you're running a campaign.
Right. So what else happened at the council meeting? Did I hear that there's a group of women suing APD?
Yeah, this was the kind of the biggest story to come out of the meeting. A class action lawsuit that eventually grew to 15 plaintiffs of women who alleged, you know, systemic failure at the Austin Police Department, by the city of Austin, by Travis County, former district attorneys, really just system-wide failures in responses and investigations to sexual assaults endured by these women. In 2018, they filed a class action lawsuit. Last year, Travis County settled their portion. And then last week, City Council voted unanimously, of course, to settle their end of the settlement. So this is a really big moment for, you know, these 15 plaintiffs, these 15 survivors of sexual assault, but really the survivor community more broadly, right? Because, of course, there is a payment awarded to the 15 plaintiffs, $825,000 payment that will be split among the 15 plaintiffs, as well as $50,000 for their attorney fees. But some of the more important aspects of this settlement for the survivor community more broadly are the commitments to reforms and policy changes at the city and at APD. Most notably, APD has committed to increasing staffing and training for the sex crimes unit. This is something that I reported on late last year. A lack of training, a lack of experience within the sex crimes unit, within the investigators there, and patrol officers who are kind of the first point of contact typically for survivors who report a sexual assault. Also, the creation of a cold case unit, which is going to be tasked with investigating cold case sexual assaults to kind of help bring resolution to some of these survivors who, you know, have been lingering in the system for far too long. And then, you know, a number of other commitments to change around policies and operations that the city says they have earmarked $862,000 for these future improvements. And they say that they've spent thus far more about $3.5 million on changes already to the way that APD handles sexual assault investigations. So a really big step forward in kind of the Austin community's broader effort to reckon with just these series of systemic failures that really began to come to light in 2016 with revelations about the failures at the forensics lab, the DNA lab in the forensics department at APD while Art Acevedo was still chief. So this is a big moment for these survivors. Of course, there's still a lot of work needs to be done. And a few survivors, some of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit spoke before the vote at the council meeting, and they were really adamant that this is a victory won by survivors, by their bravery and dedication and advocacy. It took that work for the policymakers to pay attention and finally get to this point. And they said that they will continue to pay attention, right, to continue to advocate to make sure that these promises are fulfilled, to make sure survivors don't have to be re-traumatized by a really horrendous experience with a system that's supposed to support and help them.
So what's the mood out there? Are the women themselves optimistic? Council optimistic?
Council, of course, is. They're saying this is a major victory. And it is indeed, you know, a big step forward. I think the survivors are, shall we say, maybe a little more skeptical, maybe trepidatious about promises and of the progress that's been promised and the changes that the city has said that they will make fighting this fight, given their experience fighting this fight for the past 5-6 years. You know, they've been disappointed a number of times. APD has kind of dragged their feet in making some of the changes that have so clearly been needed to make, especially within the sex crimes unit. But and certainly some of that kind of bitterness and skepticism was felt in the testimony offered by some of the plaintiffs before council took their votes. But again, this is a big step forward, and I think that there is certainly hope that the situation will improve.
Well, we certainly wish them the best, and I think we're all hoping for better days. When the story first broke there about what was about 5-6 years ago now, I wonder if how many of us really realized the scope and the breadth of it all, you know?
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think this is something that Councilmember Kassar kind of alluded to in talking about his experience with this story and supporting the survivors. He was a fresh council member when this news broke, you know? It was very early into his tenure. He had to make the choice between listening to survivors who were saying this is a big problem that needs to be dealt with, and officials at APD who were saying, as Kassar put it, he was told that survivors were making mountains out of molehills. Officials there were really trying to downplay these concerns. And as Kassar put it, he really chose to believe the survivors and listen to survivors. So I hope that that's something that our community at large takes away from this story, is the really importance of listening in this context to survivors who are so often disbelieved to the harm of themselves as individuals and then other survivors of sexual assault.
Well, really appreciate the report. They're meeting next Thursday again, is that right?
That's right, February 3rd. Chito Vela is supposed to be sworn in the next day or early in the following week.
Okay, we'll look forward to next Friday hearing all about the next city council meeting. Thanks so much for your reporting and have a great day.
Yeah, you too, Bob. Thanks.
That's all for this evening. Thanks for listening. Have a good evening and stay safe, everyone.